Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
Welcome to True Crime Cast Patreon Edition. I'm John, here with Jamie. How you doing, man?
It's April, bro.
April.
Have we ever done an April Fool's episode for Patreon?
We have talked about it over on the main show, but not for Patreon. We would never do that for you all.
Never. Today's super real.
But in other news, this will be our last Patreon episode ever.
April Fool's. You looked at me. I was like, is he serious?
It is unfortunate timing. I mean, I have medical tests pending right now, so yeah. We'll update
John's
you later.
Last one. It won't be mine. It's April. That's kind of wild. I was trying to think of case updates. The Doug Harless case that we've covered out of London, Kentucky, which got us in a bunch of hot water somehow. So they released his autopsy report recently, John. He was shot in his head, in his neck, in his chest, and in his arms.
Yeah. I can't say I'm surprised.
I mean,
what if they came back and said he actually died of a heart attack?
Just in case people missed it, cops went into his house and it was the wrong house and they shot and killed him.
Okay. You said Doug Harless, but in my mind, I'm thinking of the judge that got shot in chambers.
No.
So,
no, okay.
Doug Harless out of London, Laurel County. Sorry. Yes. I'm there with you, Dale.
I thought you were thinking about the mayor of London. Anyway,
no.
There's so much going on. But no, he was shot in his head, his neck, his belly, and his arms. So the police broke into his house, the wrong house, and shot him many, many times.
There's so much to
that story.
That
makes me so angry.
Yeah, there's so much to the story, and unfortunately, it doesn't appear as if a whole lot is resolved yet. But of course, there's stuff happening behind the scenes that will never be made public, especially in this case.
Yeah, it's terrible. But that's the main update I have. I unfortunately don't have any updates on the judge that was shot with Sheriff Mickey Steins, and nothing really moving right there right now.
Yep, but we have some interesting, I don't know, it's an interesting idea. So why don't you get the ball rolling and then you can explain it while you do so.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about a lot of wrongful convictions on this show, and we've covered cases where science messes up, where witnesses get it wrong. And unfortunately, we also cover cases where the prosecutors are the ones that screw this up. So we've talked a lot about Brady violations over the years. And at its core, the Brady violation is a Brady law. And essentially it says that a prosecutor had evidence that could have helped the defendant, and they didn't hand it over. So the prosecutor withholding evidence from the prosecution that could help is a Brady violation. It sounds super boring, but for all of the cases that it has impacted over time is just so many. So we thought we would kind of break down where that law comes from and some major cases that it is applied to.
Yeah, so because I need to be talked to like I'm five sometimes, if I'm on trial for murdering someone named Jami, then if the county attorney's office had a piece of evidence that would actually benefit me and they refused to give it over to my defense team, that is a Brady violation.
Yeah. So if after the trial they found out that was withheld, then you could get an appeal just based on that.
So I think it's important that we go back to the beginning and understand Brady, because Brady means someone named Brady.
Yeah, it's not just a random name. I remember the Brady Bill when we were kids where you had to wait to pry a gun. That's the only Brady I've ever known that was famous. Tom Brady? It's
Brady,
not that one.
The Brady Bunch, brother?
Brady Bunch?
That's the only thing in my mind right now.
No, so it's none of those, but there is a Brady.
So to understand why we have the Brady rule, we have to go back to a case called Brady versus Maryland and understand what happened in it. So before 1963, criminal trials operated on something that legal scholars sometimes call the sporting theory of justice.
Doesn't sound good.
So the idea was that the trial was essentially a contest. Two sides, each keeping their cards close to their chest, each trying to win. Defense attorneys had no automatic right to see what evidence the prosecution had gathered and would ultimately use in trial. It was, you know, it was interesting. If a detective had interviewed a witness who said the defendant wasn't there, the defense might never get to know that information, which is really unfortunate because whether you're the defense or the prosecutor, justice only equals justice if the right people are held accountable.
Right.
So you would think that even before 1963, we would all be on the same team that is humanity, but apparently not.
No, I think we were on the same team, or the prosecution was on the team of let's get people put away. Before that, the only obligation that existed was a really narrow one that came from a case called Mooney versus Holohan, which said that prosecutors couldn't knowingly use false testimony to convict somebody. So
the only rule was don't lie.
Yes, don't put crap, don't make up evidence, essentially, yeah. Which is a pretty low bar.
You know, the if you don't tell the truth, but you also don't say a lie, that's okay too.
Yes.
You know,
like
just withholding information because perfectly it doesn't fine. Help you.
At least you're not lying.
So that's a very low bar. And it said nothing about the mountain of evidence that could exist that wasn't false testimony. So into the landscape comes the case of John Leo Brady. On June 27th, 1958, Brady and a companion named Charles Donald Bobbitt murdered a 53-year-old man named William Brooks in Maryland. The circumstances were that Brady and Bobbitt had stolen Brooks' car as part of a plan to rob a bank. According to Brady, the plan was never supposed to include killing anyone, but Brooks was killed. He was strangled. Both of these men were charged with first-degree murder. They ended up being tried separately, and at his own trial, Brady took the stand and admitted that he had been involved, but he insisted that Bobbitt, not him, was the one who had done the actual killing. His attorney's entire closing argument was built around one ask: convict him of first-degree murder if you must, but please don't give him the death penalty. So the jury gave him the death penalty anyway, and Brady was sentenced to die.
Aha, they got him. Yeah, this was horrible. And there was something that the defense didn't know at this time. It was that nobody on the defense team knew was that Boblett, I think there's an L in there, Boblett had given a written statement that admitted that he alone had committed the actual murder.
Oh, my gosh.
The confession of another person.
That is very much the reason why we have the Brady law.
Super important, right? So his attorneys.
How could you? Oh, my gosh. That is terrible.
With a good conscience, how can you put somebody to death? Give them the death penalty knowing this. The attorney had specifically asked the prosecution if he could review all of Boblett's statements before trial. Some statements were turned over, but obviously the one where he confessed was withheld. Brady eventually found out that it existed after he had already been convicted and had a death sentence. So he appealed based on this information.